Now ask our Brother Malcolm to give us those much-needed words of exhortation. Brother Malcolm.
There are quite a number of Bible stories, as we refer to them, that almost everybody that has had any connection at all with the with Christianity is fully aware of. You may, for instance, this last week have had comments from people that you just didn't expect to hear these comments from, references to Noah. And that, of course, was brought about by the period of continuous rainy days that we've just come through. And it's surprising then what things that just happen to us bring out these little remembrances from people that we think have maybe had no connection at all to Sunday school or to any other part of religion, and yet they're part of our culture. Also, interestingly, as I was driving to a meeting this morning, I pulled up behind a pickup truck at a red light, and there on the bumper of the truck was a reference to walking on water. There are all sorts of little things that that are part of our heritage. Our language has been affected by the Bible, the way we express ourselves. It comes up in many ways. And one of the little stories that everybody is very familiar with is here in the 17th chapter of Matthew, which was read this morning. I speak, of course, of the Transfiguration. Now, the word transfigure has, the word which is, the Greek word which is translated transfigure here, has come down into our English language as the word metamorphosis. It's based, this word which is translated transfigure is, has arisen from the word metamorpho, which is, has given us the concept of metamorphosis. Now, when we think of a metamorphosis, we probably think of a butterfly. And you think then of the idea of a caterpillar changing into a chrysalis, and a chrysalis later on changing into the adult form of that flies around on very, very pretty and very delicate wings. It's a complete transformation, a complete change from one state to another. Now, we'll look at this idea again in a minute, but before we go into this, which is here written in Matthew 17, I would like you to just get hold of the notion that the word which has given us this concept of transfiguration, a change, is a real change. A real and an obvious and an unmistakable change. Now the story as it unfolds is of course that Jesus took three of his closest disciples and he went up into a hill, up into a mountain with them. Now, some translations use the word private, privately. He went away privately. And that gives, I think, a little better notion of what happened than the word apart, which is there in my translation. So Jesus made a real effort to get away from people, to gain a little privacy with three of his most trusted associates. Now, normally, when Jesus withdraws from the group that he's been associated with, it, we're given some reason for him going. And quite often, he goes apart and separates himself from people in order to pray. But on this occasion, we're not given a reason. Jesus simply left. He took three most trusted associates with him, and they withdrew from the group of people that they were associated with, the other disciples, and the crowds which must have been there, for they greeted him when he came back from this mountain. Now, when Jesus was up there, we're given, again, no introduction, no explanation, no interpretation of what's gone on. It's just that suddenly it seems that Jesus changed his appearance. And there were also two others who shared that same experience, who shared that same appearance with him. They're Moses and Elijah. And the change in appearance was that Jesus shone brilliantly. His clothing and his face, certainly, shone. Now, we have seen that before, of course. We've seen that in Moses, and we'll come back to that in a moment. But before we go any further, and before we come back to the details of the story, just bear in mind that there was no question that the disciples were still looking at Jesus. They still recognized him. They knew it was Jesus, so we weren't looking at the sort of metamorphosis that I described to you earlier, where a caterpillar changes from another completely distinctly different state, and then into a third state, none of which seem in any way like the state which was there before. It's not that much of a huge change, because Jesus was still known to those that looked at him. And yet his appearance was changed, changed dramatically, changed drastically. Now, in response to this, we meet Peter. And there was, of course, a discussion going on between the three individuals that were exuded this very brilliant light. And Peter, in response to what was going on, said, well, maybe we should make some little booths. So, Mark, the other record of the Transfiguration is there in Mark. It's in the 9th chapter of Mark. And Mark adds a rather interesting little point there. Peter, it says, was afraid, nervous, or something of that nature. He wasn't comfortable in this arrangement. And yet Peter, being a man of action, figured that, well, we must do something. And so it seemed that out of this nervous state that Peter was in came the suggestion that, well, we got to do something. Let's make some little shelters. Now, why do that? Well, I wonder whether Peter thought that possibly they would be there for some time and it would be appropriate to provide some means of shelter for them, which were up on a rather exposed area, so that his Lord and the guests would have some shelter in that time. Maybe, I don't know. It may also be that Peter simply was dazzled by the brilliance and felt that indeed it was important to shade this brightness which was coming. Although there may have been another reason, and we'll come back to that in a moment. But anyway, with Peter's suggestion and shortly thereafter, came a bright cloud down and descended, not on them, but it says it overshadowed them. Now that's reminiscent of the Spirit of God moving on the face of the water when in the time of creation. It's reminiscent of a number of occasions where we have the presence of God coming close to the people who were there and being discussed at a particular time. And out of that brightness, that bright cloud, came a voice proclaiming that Jesus was indeed God's Son and that we should hear him. The disciples were really afraid at this time. There was a time in the beginning of the prophet Ezekiel where Ezekiel saw a vision, and the vision impressed Ezekiel to the point that he fell on his face, and that was the thing which, that was the response which we have from these disciples at that time, that they were now overcome by the brightness which was around them. And there was another event, another time, when this same circumstance was to happen, wasn't it? And that was at the time when Paul was on the road to Damascus. And the brilliance of God's presence forced people to the ground. Well, then Jesus said, don't worry, it's time to get up. And they did, and everything was back to normal. Moses and Elijah were nowhere to be seen. Jesus was apparently quite the way they had always known him. And they returned to the group that they had left some time earlier. Well, at this point, they started to discuss what had gone on. And again, we're indebted to Mark for adding just an interesting little point into the story. For it seems that what they were talking about at this point was this concept of rising, this resurrection, this concept of rising from the dead, as it is worded in my translation. And then out of that came this question, why do the scribes say that Elijah must first come? And Jesus answered that one by saying, yes, indeed, he must first come. But, in a sense, Elijah had already come. And then they realized that he was talking about John, John the Baptist, or John the Immerser, as it is more precisely translated in some of the other versions which we have. So with that little sort of sketch and reminder of what there is in the story, let's just go back and look at some of the things that are here. Well, let's impress upon ourselves, first of all, that what's there in the second verse. And Jesus was transfigured before them. His face did shine as the sun, and his raiment was white as the light. And there appeared unto them Moses and Elijah, Elias, as it's in our New Testament translations, talking with him. They were talking, there were the three of them, and there was brilliant light, certainly emanating from Jesus. Now, why Moses and why Elijah? Why should those three be there? That's one question. And the other question, of course, is that the people who were there with Jesus had absolutely no way of recognizing, they could recognize Jesus, but there was no possible way that they could recognize Moses. He had been dead for a long time. And there was no possible way that they could recognize Elijah. There was no earthly way that they could have seen either of those people. How would they recognize them? Well, very interestingly, if you think about it for a moment, well, and if you visited any of the large cathedrals in throughout Europe and looked at some of the stained glass windows, you'll realize that if you sort of look at them for a while, you'll realize that indeed you can tell each of the characters, even if there are no words there. Now, you can tell the people that are in the stained glass window for two or three reasons. And the one is the position in the window. The dominant character is always towards the top and right in the middle of the window. And the subordinate characters then come out below them. So in this case, you would probably see someone right in the center with two people right beside him and three more a little further down. So that you would know that there were six people in the story. They were grouped into two groups and one was preeminent above all the other six, above the other five. But the other thing is that in the stained glass iconography which prevailed all through the Middle Ages, most people couldn't read at that time, so most people then, when they looked at a stained glass window, if they were to interpret it at all, had to know who they were looking at by what they saw. Moses brought the law. So when Moses was displayed in a stained glass setting, Moses would have a tablet or something of that nature with him, with Hebrew writing on it, which would indicate that indeed he was the one who brought the law. And with that, then, we would know who we were talking about, and with the others around, you would know which particular aspect of Moses' story, life story, that was being displayed in the stained glass window. Peter was a fisherman, and Peter, whenever Peter appeared in a stained glass setting, would have some fish with him. And so you could always identify that apostle by the presence of fish along with him. You see, they were identified by things which they had done. And that was the point to all of that iconography. That people had things which they had achieved within the Bible setting that everyone would know about and everyone would be aware of and everyone would recognize that person for what they had done. And that's important. That point is important as we step into this concept of the transfiguration and what's seen here. The characters must have been known for two things. One, what they said, because Jesus was discussing with those two individuals. And secondly, that it would be obvious what they had done in their lifetime, which caused them to shine in the presence of Jesus. So what was it with Moses? And what was it with Elijah? And in Jesus' day, what was it that he was doing? Well, the time when Moses' face had shone, of course, was at the time when he came down from the mountain with two tablets of stone. Now, it just so happens that this was the second time that Moses had come down from the mountain. Now, the first time that Moses went up into that mountain, he was summoned to go there, and he was away for an extended period, some 40 days. Now, while Moses was away, people began to doubt what was happening to them. If you remember the circumstances surrounding Moses being up in that mountain, they were rather frightening. And if you recall then that the effect that that could very well have upon people, and the way people nowadays respond to things like the description which is there in the book of Exodus, it's hardly surprising that one would say to oneself, well, what's happened to Moses? Probably he's not going to come back. And it's also possible that one would think that with Moses disappearing in such frightening circumstances, that the God that had led them this far had now deserted Moses, and as a result, where there was, must have been questions in their minds as to whether this God which had brought them this far had any meaning in their lives. And so it was hardly surprising then, when you look at it from this very human point of view, that the Israelites decided that maybe they should choose another God. And into that setting of doubt, of real doubt about the religion that they had been following to this point, of realizing that this religion had no real framework in their lives to this point in time anyway, came Moses back from the mountain into that picture of grave doubt among the people that he had left. He brought the law with him. He brought a way of life which was to lead them in the days ahead. But the first interaction was not a happy one. Moses lost his temper, and the people that were there were very surprised to see him back, and no doubt rather ashamed of what had happened. But Moses went back, cut the tablets of stone, brought them back, and the second time there was a much happier exchange between the two. So Moses brought the law to them. He brought it to them at a time when they desperately needed picking up. He brought it to them at a time when the circumstances made them wonder about where their society was going, where they were going as individuals, and where the religion that Moses had guided them into at that point in time had any meaning in their lives. Does it begin to sound familiar? Does it begin to sound familiar? Two other little points. That at that point, when Moses came back the second time, the brilliance of his meeting with God exuded from his face. And Moses had to cover his face. And we'll meet this point again in Corinthians. And we'll meet this point again when we think about the booths that were constructed. And the brilliance of Moses' face had to be covered so that people could actually stay in his presence. Everybody knew it was Moses. They still knew it was Moses the way the disciples knew it was Jesus at the time of the transfiguration. But the brilliance of his face overpowered them. Why Elijah? Why Elijah? Well, what was Elijah well known for? And certainly there were a few miracles. There were a certain number of really personal exchanges which showed a very compassionate aspect and a real concern for impoverished individuals in Jewish society at that time. There was compassion There was certainly that about Elijah. But probably the thing that Elijah was best known and most remembered for was the place, was the time when he confronted those prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel, when he brought that fire from heaven, when he called fire down and God answered with a blast from heaven that consumed both the sacrifices which were there on the table and the priests themselves. So it was, I think, the most dramatic thing was that Elijah stood up to a society that was again, as said when the Israelites formed that golden calf, that Elijah stood up before a society that was really wondering about the value of their religion in their lives, was really flirting with alternative religions, was really wondering about the desirability of alternative lifestyles, because that in many ways was what the worship of Baal brought into Jewish society. And Elijah stood against that, in spite of great hardship, in spite of being really discarded by the society that he was in on at least two occasions. Elijah continually stood against that. And finally, he overcame that trouble which was in Jewish society at that time. And Elijah made it clear that there was meaning to the religion that had buoyed this people and given their society structure from the time of Moses. But again, it was at a time when people doubted, severely doubted, the value of their religion and the importance of their religion in their lives, and were really wondering whether there were better ways and more interesting ways of framing one's life, of leading one's life, and of providing a form of worship. So, does that sound familiar? There's an old saying, the more things change, the more they stay the same. And what about Jesus, the third individual that was changed so dramatically in presence on the mountain? What about the society that Jesus came into? A society, again, that was walking a tightrope between the demands of their church, the demands of their religion, the demands of their way of life, and the demands of an occupying power, the power of Rome. A society whose religious leaders were in the middle of this balancing act and who were making a lot of decisions, not for the values which they should have espoused, but rather for the demands which were there, of the demands of their own particular personal position, in a state where circumstances were, by and large, dictated by a foreign authority. Where people were wondering if there was an easier way of doing things for the sake of peace. Where people were wondering whether the most important thing in their life was to stay alive and stay comfortable rather than to follow the boundaries of their religion. Does that sound familiar? So you see, into a period of history which was much the same came these three figures. The one from the law, the one who was probably the forerunner of the major prophets, and the one who came to announce the new covenant. They were transfigured, they were bright, they were on the mountain. And as we said from Mark's record, Peter didn't know what to do. And so he said, well, let's make some little shelters. And as we said, there are several reasons that one could make those shelters. But I wonder whether Peter actually had a little note of inspiration, and whether, in spite of the fact that he appeared not to really know what he wanted to do, was actually doing something which had real meaning, both to the story and to those of us who in this day and age read it again. He said, let's build three little tabernacles. One for Moses, one for Elijah, and one for Jesus. That we should put these three aspects of the development of God's purpose into a shelter. The law, the prophets, and the new covenant. Now, of course, it harks back to the time when the Israelites used to build little booths, the Feast of Booths, the Feast of Ingathering, as it's called, the Feast of Tabernacles, as it is referred to in many of the translations which we have, and with the biblical translations that we have. So, what was it about that Feast of Tabernacles which made it special? Well, nowadays, we, in Orthodox Church circles, would call this a harvest festival. It was a time when people were grateful for the bounty of the earth which was there and which would sustain them through yet another year. It was a time when people realized that they were dependent on the plants that grow in the ground, on the crops that we plant, and that these crops had again come to fruition. And those people who believe in the bounty of God realized that that is there by the hand of God and the provision of God. And the Israelite people, at the time when they were to remember this harvest, this annual harvest, were instructed to make little outdoor tents and go and live in them. And they were told that they were to remember that they were doing this because in the time when they came out of Egypt, they lived as migrants. They lived the way the Bedouins do today. They lived in little tents and they moved their tent from place to place. I wonder whether they did begin to make the connection that they were one of the first significant aspects of God's harvest. That God's people were being brought to fruition when they were brought out of Egypt and placed in their own free land. I wonder whether these people made the connection between the idea that just as the harvest developed annually, that they too were one of the first stages in God's harvest. And so I wonder whether there was wisdom in Peter's selection of the idea of making booths on that occasion. Elijah was essentially saying the same thing. That you've got to get back. You've got to bring yourself back into a situation where you are indeed part of God's harvest and not part of Baal's harvest. And Jesus used that image in a number of his parables. The harvest is plentiful indeed, but the workers are few. So I wonder whether there was wisdom in what Peter decided to do, for realizing that here we have three aspects of the development of God's purpose, which was all leading to the gathering of a people in God's name. Well, the three individuals, Jesus and Moses and Elijah, were talking to one another. They were discussing something. And as we have said, it's quite possible that one of the ways that Peter was able and that Peter and James and John were able to recognize these three individuals, Jesus they knew, Moses would have a debating point of view, and Elijah too would have his debating point of view. And being familiar with the scriptures, they would know what point of view each was bringing into the discussion. They would be aware of what each had done and how each fitted in to the moving purpose of God. But there are things that they didn't clearly understand. And one of them came out right now. And as we said earlier, we're indebted to Mark for pointing this out. They began to discuss among themselves what this rising from the dead meant. And then you see, when you get into the imagery of Romans, we nowadays can look back and say, yes, we understand it. One of the things that we're talking about here is indeed God's harvest, which came about through this concept of resurrection. But there was the more immediate point, wasn't there? There was the more immediate point that the message of God would go no further unless Jesus came back from his death and was resurrected. And so that was the first thing. The other thing, of course, which was discussed was what's the real position of Elijah in all this? Why was Elijah picked instead of Isaiah, for instance, to represent the movement of the prophets? Or Jeremiah or Ezekiel with Ezekiel's image of the time of the end, the temple of the final temple and such like. Why not pick Ezekiel? Well, of course, because there was the little idea in Scripture that Elijah was here as a forerunner of many ideas. Elijah was there as a forerunner of the ideas which the major prophets presented. And Elijah then was picked up as a concept of a forerunner to Christ. And the concept of there being a forerunner is extended, as we see here. So there was a message to be presented. That was the reason that Elijah was there. There was a message to be presented. And it was the presentation of that message and the immersing of their lives in the presentation of that message which came out in the brilliance which was there in their faces, in the changing of their appearance. The word transfigured occurs two other times in the New Testament. And in neither of those places is it translated the same way. It's just in the two records of the Transfiguration, Matthew and Mark, that the word change, metamorphos, is there translated as transfigured. In Corinthians, in 2 Corinthians 3, we have a little discussion about the circumstances around Moses bringing the law down the mountain, about the idea that Moses had to cover his face when that law was delivered to the people, because the brilliance which was there in Moses and the appearance of Moses was too much for those who looked at him. A time when Moses brought the law into their lives, that was too great an experience for people to look at, to comprehend. And so the idea was presented that indeed Moses had to cover his face in that occasion. And then after discussing this, Paul concludes his discussion of what's gone on with Christ and what went on in the time of Moses with these words. But we all, this is the last verse of the third chapter of 2 Corinthians, but we all with open face beholding as in a glass the glory of the Lord, are changed into that same image from glory to glory, even as by the Spirit of the Lord. But we, with open face, beholding in a glass the glory of the Lord. Now that's interesting because it's sort of circuitous, isn't it? You're looking quite openly, but you're not looking directly. You're looking in a glass at what's going on there. And again, there's this concept that we cannot stand the brilliance which is there. But we can see it. We can behold it. We can behold it in the writings of Paul and others. And the reason, the thing that unlocks it for us, that unlocks all of these ideas and brings us fully into the presence of this glory, is the Lord Jesus and the message which we have there. In the 14th verse, before this, you see, the veil is done away in Christ. And we're referring there to the veil which covered Moses' face. The brightness which was there, which was too much for the Israelites, we can now see because of Jesus. But we have to be changed. We can't stay the same if we are to actually see that brightness. And that's what this last verse in Corinthians is driving at. The Hebrew people in their day had to change. When Moses went away the first time, their reaction was, this religion's not getting us anywhere. Let's chuck it. When Moses came back the second time, they knew they had made a mistake. When Elijah came onto the scene, the people around them said, well, look, Ahab's got us onto a good thing here. He's made good political connections, smart marriages. We're now at peace with everybody around us and so on. And not only that, there's a lot of fun things going on in our society that we rather enjoy. Let's not pay so much attention to the religion which had been part of their lives to that point. And Elijah changed that. And Jesus, in many places, made it quite clear that there were values far and above the values that people talked about in their everyday lives. And that needed to be part of their way of thinking. That change had to happen in them. And additionally, Paul is telling us here in Corinthians that we have to make similar changes if we are to comprehend what has been done on our behalf by Jesus. The fourth place, of course, where this word is used is in Romans, in the 12th chapter of Romans, the second verse. I beseech you, brethren, the first verse of Romans 12 says, by the mercies of God, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. And not be conformed to the world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that ye may prove what is good and acceptable and perfect will of God. And be ye transformed. And that's the word which is translated as transfigured in the transfiguration story. That's translated as changed in that little reference to what had gone on in the time of Moses and the way it relates to Jesus' preaching in Corinthians. But be ye not conformed to the world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Well, it's kind of fun, isn't it, to sort of take apart some of these Bible stories. Whenever I get onto this tangent, I remember Brother Harry Whittaker coming through many years ago, and he had a title for some of his talks, Bible Stories You Think You Know. It was really quite fun to listen to Harry because he would take apart these little things that, oh, we'd fall familiar with, you know, and say, did you think of this? I hope that in some way I've given you just a little bit of that in relation to this transfiguration story this morning. A little bit of a, did you think of that? Now, that's fascinating. And personally, I really like to do it. But that's not exhortation. So, what's the exhortation? What can we take out of this story? And what should I have said and what could I have said in about a dozen words? Well, the point was that the close association that Jesus had with his God led to a real change. That change was visible. And that change was acknowledged by his God. And what Paul in Corinthians says is that we too need to change our lives somewhat if we are to comprehend and benefit from the message which God has given us. And what Paul says to us in Romans is that we must change, and we've got to use our minds to change the activities which we proclaim and which we do. And then by so doing, maybe we will be similar and be part of that concept which is presented to us here in the story of transfiguration and which will come back in the final stages of resurrection. So what the transfiguration story really shows to us is that we must allow God's word to change our lives, to affect us personally. So, I have a question for you. When Jesus said, let your light so shine before men, what did he mean?